Welcome to another episode of the Oncology on the Go podcast. I'm your host, Russ Conroy. In this episode, my colleague Haley Virgil spoke with Sarah Donahue, a nurse practitioner from the University of California, San Francisco. The discussion focused on managing toxicity associated with different classes of drugs for patients with metastatic breast cancer, including antibody drug conjugates and CDK4/6 inhibitors. For example, Donahue spoke about mitigating nausea following treatment with trastuzumab deruxtecan, as well as managing fatigue and hot flashes associated with ribociclib and palbociclib.
So I know we're having a conversation today about adverse effect management for a couple of different classes of drugs. So I thought maybe we could start off by talking about ADCs. So what types of adverse effects do we ordinarily see with ADCs?
There's two ADCs right now that I'm thinking of. There's trastuzumab deruxtecan and sacituzumab govitecan, both with very, very different adverse effect profiles. Whenever we're talking about ADCs, we need to consider both the antibody and the chemotherapy that's being stuck on that antibody and brought to the cells. These are more targeted. However, there is going to be some systemic effects that you have from them, just because the chemotherapy may sort of come off of the antibody as it travels to the cancer, or once it gets there, it can have more sort of systemic effects than you would hope for, but very manageable. And when we compare those, I think in many of the studies that they looked at these medications, whether or not they're in this population of hormone positive, HER2 negative patients, but just in all the studies, and they compared it to standard of care, there was a little bit less, there were less side effects, but again, there still are side effects that are systemic. So with trastuzumab deruxtecan, many of my patients that are hormone positive, metastatic breast cancer patients, HER2 negative, or they're considered HER2 low would qualify for this. And many of them have never had a medication like trastuzumab before. So just addressing that, the trastuzumab can cause the cardio effects. So making sure to monitor the echocardiogram every 3 months. Again, I don't see that those rates are higher than trastuzumab in the other trials or trastuzumab with other chemotherapies like trastuzumab and tamoxifen, but they do have that, so you have to monitor for it. The other main side effects of that medication, really what I see is mostly nausea. So it's pretty common. It's a moderate emetogenic medication. So you're giving a lot of premedications. It's almost like you're giving doxorubicin, cyclophosphamide. I mean, you're giving them the works, and then you're making sure that at home they have the antiemetics to use as needed. Sometimes in the first cycle, I'll have patients schedule it because it's harder to catch up with that. Just like with pain, it's harder to catch up with that. And I don't want to create a situation where every time they're coming in, they're thinking about the nausea that they had last time and worried and having that anticipatory nausea as well. So I give them a lot of these medications to take at home with a little bit of scheduling. What I found is that some of these patients will have like a nausea that occurs for longer than you would expect with a medication. So what I find is adding on olanzapine at bedtime for the first like 3 to 5 nights, starting the night of treatment, really, really helps. And sometimes I have patients just continue with that even longer or take it as needed, and they are needing it later on. When we're talking about how the patient's like quality of life is, if they're not eating well, they're nauseated, they're going to have some level of fatigue, just low blood sugar, lack of hydration because they're not feeling well to drink. So a lot of my sort of goals in making them feel as normal as possible and having the least amount of fatigue is so that they can do what they want to be doing, which makes them feel better emotionally too, is really, really targeting that nausea and making sure that it is very well controlled. And they're letting me know right away if it's not, so that I can intervene and help them. So at my institution, because these side effects occur after treatment, of course, the patients are home, we're used to this. Just having a good like nursing team that's easily reachable by the patients is really important. So at UCSF, we have a phone number that they can call and speak directly to a nurse. Sometimes there's some waits. So I have them also write in a message through our electronic medical system, and they can get usually a phone call within an hour or two. So that is for trastuzumab deruxtecan, the main issue going on. There are some drops in blood counts, but really not a whole lot. Most patients don't need white blood cell promoters during their treatment, but I have had some patients that have required it, but it's not the majority of the issue. Hair loss has become sort of something that I do always discuss with patients, because about 40% of patients do lose a significant amount of hair, meaning more than 50%. But it's often, if that does happen, it will start growing back later. It's not like a perpetually worsening issue that happens for them. We have cold caps at our institution that we are trying with it as well, so I can offer that. So with the other treatment, sacituzumab govitecan, there's a lot less nausea. It's something where I have some patients experience it, but usually it's because they're experiencing the other side effect, which is which is more like diarrhea, abdominal cramping that can occur with that medication. They can have, with sacituzumab govitecan, the sacituzumab really doesn't have toxicity that I found, but the govitecan the govitecan is the active metabolite SN38 of irinotecan, which we all know very well, but it's much, much more potent. So what I'm having patients experience is this acute sort of abdominal cramping, plus or minus diarrhea at the time of the infusion while they're in the infusion center. And then they can have this delayed diarrhea and cramping that can happen like 3 to 5 days later. Most of what I'm seeing is more cramping in my experience, but there was quite a bit of diarrhea in the studies. So I always have them in the beginning, they're ordered for atropine while they're in the infusion center, and that can help with the cramping immediately and for that acute diarrhea. And then they have loperamide at home that they can take. The diarrhea at home, they can be taking loperamide for that. What I found is if there's a lot of cramping that's occurring, even if it's later on, like 3 days later, I like to add the Lamotil in because it has the atropine as part of it, and it's really great for cramping. I will say that I have had patients where that diarrhea is more than grade two, or it's grade three or more. They're having 7+ episodes of diarrhea in a 24-hour period. And in those patients, often when they come back for their next cycle, I'm decreasing their dose of the sacituzumab govitecan just to help them tolerate it better, hydrate better, not lose weight during treatment, because we know that when you lose weight during treatment, you don't tolerate as well, you have more fatigue. And then there's the issue with sacituzumab govitecan that trastuzumab deruxtecan doesn't have, which is neutropenia. Super common with this medication. So in a patient that is getting sacituzumab govitecan, often they're heavily pretreated, meaning it's a later line therapy for the hormone positive HER2 negative breast cancer patients. So they may have a bone marrow that's a little bit more sensitive to chemotherapy. So we'll be having them use some GCSF after treatment. Sometimes I'll do the first cycle without it if there's somebody that did fine previously. If they didn't do fine previously with their previous lines of therapy, I'll start right off the bat using the GCSF. One of the other side effects of sacituzumab govitecan is you can have an infusion reaction. So the first treatment is given over a much longer period of time. There's premedications with things like dexamethasone and diphenhydramine to prevent that as well. So I always counsel patients on that.
All right. That was excellent. Thank you so much for that. And that's great because you pretty much answered the next question I was going to ask you about managing these adverse effects. So instead, what might be good for us to talk about Are there any factors that you take into consideration when anticipating these toxicities in terms of who might be at greater risk, or maybe just in terms of managing these toxicities?
I'm going to add one more thing to the last that I just thought of. Sacituzumab govitecan does cause hair loss. And we do have to tell patients that they're going to likely lose their hair. But when I'm meeting a patient or starting them on treatment with one of these antibody drug conjugates, I'm always thinking about how they did previously on their prior therapy. So a patient that is often having nausea with prior therapies, I'm going to be very aggressive with my anti-emetic regimen on trastuzumab deruxtecan. I'm going to really, really schedule their at-home medication, start them off with the olanzapine at bedtime, no matter what, tell them that they can continue it for the full, first 2 weeks after treatment if they want, like just encourage them to take more. And then schedule even the ondansetron or prochlorperazine or lorazepam for a few days after to really help them with that. For a patient that I know has had diarrhea with prior therapies, maybe they had a lot of diarrhea with the abemaciclib or something like that, whatever they would have been on prior, I would have them schedule even their loperamide after treatment potentially. Or make sure that they have the Lamotil right off the bat at home to be taking and let them know to contact us right away. And just like I said earlier, if somebody that I know required G-CSF for their last line of chemotherapy, if they're on sacituzumab govitecan, I will likely be making sure that they have off for the G-CSF just going into the treatment and even scheduling them for at least one dose, like a few days after each infusion. To make sure that they're not dropping too low. I have had some patients where I've started them off in a lower dose. So maybe I have a patient that their bone marrow previously required two or three shots of G-CSF after their 2 weeks on, 1 week off chemotherapy regimen. With that patient, I may not be starting at the full dose for sacituzumab govitecan. Maybe I'll start them off at one dose reduction just to do that first cycle and then consider increasing it later. I've had patients that have had a lot of fatigue on previous treatments that I've started on lower doses to start as well. But really looking at your patient, thinking this is what your goal is to not only prolong their life, but preserve quality of life. And just thinking about that very deeply before you give them these treatments. It's not about being aggressive. It's about helping them live a little bit longer, but with good quality.
Yeah, no, definitely like taking their goals for their care into consideration. That's a really great point.
Absolutely. We sometimes forget about that, I think, maybe.
I feel like that comes up every now and again in these conversations. So definitely really important to mention.
Yeah.
Well, all right. I wanted to pivot on over to the CDK4/6 inhibitor space. Obviously, like we were talking about earlier, that there's been a lot of really big conversations about CDK4/6 inhibitors this year, not even counting the past couple of months where we've seen a lot of data readout. So what does the adverse effect profile look like for CDK4/6 inhibitors?
So we have three CDK4/6 inhibitors. Two of them are very similar in their profiles, and one of them sort of is a little bit different. Palbociclib and ribociclib both can cause neutropenia. And so we're giving them 3 weeks on, 1 week off for that reason. And we're checking labs a lot. They both can cause fatigue. And they both can cause mouth sores. And they're always given with hormone therapy. So the side effects of the hormone therapy can sort of be added on. Usually it's a fulvestrant, or an aromatase inhibitor. So it may be hot flashes if it's the fulvestrant, or it might be more like arthralgia and hot flashes for your aromatase inhibitor. So they all come together. What I think drive home with patients is that these are first line therapy for your hormone positive metastatic breast cancer patient. And so I'm hoping that they're going to be on this for a long time. The study showed 2+ years was the median progression-free survival for these patients. So this is a long time, maybe even longer than that 2 years. And we need to make sure that they're active, exercising a lot. That really helps with the fatigue. It helps with the arthralgia from the aromatase inhibitors. We make sure that they are treating their hot flashes, especially if those are leading to any sort of insomnia. So that's incredibly important. So these medications really, really are a game changer, I think, it's been out for a while, but if you really go back and think about it, when they first came out, we didn't have that length of progression-free survival with our hormone therapy alone, first-line therapy. So they've just really made patients' lives so much better. I have patients that have been on them for 10 years, for 5 years, and they're, living their lives. And I think that they're forgetting that they have metastatic breast cancer for at least the time between the labs and when they see me. I'm hoping that they are, but very well tolerated generally. And if your patient is having a lot of fatigue, you can dose reduce. Often we're dose reducing anyways, because they're having issues with neutropenia. So that can help with the fatigue. With abemaciclib, I'm generally not using that first line. It's more of a second line therapy. That has more diarrhea with it, less of the decreased counts. Patients can take it continuously without break. So the labs don't get affected as much, but the diarrhea can be pretty tough in the beginning for some patients. So making sure that they're using their loperamide as needed, but then also sometimes I'm having them schedule it preventively, noting that they can take up to 8 tabs a day, that it's something that's expected, that we can easily reduce if the loperamide's not working, with doing things like dose reducing just even a little bit. And in those trials, many of the patients had a dose reduce. I think something like 40% had to because of diarrhea. And just knowing that they still did well in the trial, the trial was still a positive trial, is really important.
Is there anything else that you want to mention with regard to, especially considering how first line patients can be on that regimen for so long? Any tips that you have for just in terms of how you manage those adverse effects?
Just having them be able to reach out to you right away to tell you how they're feeling so that you can help them. I have patients that sometimes don't want to reach out, but I find that if they reach out, we can intervene quickly. We have so much experience in managing these side effects, and we have so many great tips that we can give them that it's better if they reach out right away and let us know how they're feeling. I also find that most patients do tolerate these so well for the long term. I think there's a lot that we can do in nursing to help patients tolerate these medications much better before we dose reduce. So giving that patient that benefit of the doubt of helping them with those symptoms before reducing the dose. I mean, definitely I keep mentioning that we can always dose reduce, but first is to try to prevent the treatments with, loperamide or whatever the exercise, whatever your intervention is, but really make sure that patients are doing those things before you decide to go down on the dose.
Yeah, it's kind of like adopting that prophylactic strategy instead of just waiting for it to happen. That makes a lot of sense.
Or just being too jumpy about the dose. I've had some patients where they've come from outside institutions and they're like, oh, well, I had, diarrhea for a week. I didn't really like the loperamide. And so they reduced my dose and now I'm reduced. And I think, oh, they can wait a little longer.
No, that's a great point.
Yeah.
What do you hope that the oncology community who's listening to this conversation takes away from it?
I think the main thing that I find most helpful for my patients is to explain the potential side effects, explain that there's something that we can do about them, that we can intervene. If they reach out to us sooner, we can help them more. With regards to the CDK4/6 inhibitors, I have a lot of patients that worry that maybe when their white blood cells are low and they're on this for long term, they're thinking, oh my God, I'm not going to be able to go see family or go out in public because I'm going to be neutropenic. And just sort of driving home that the neutropenia that happens with the CDK4/6 inhibitors isn't something that leads to neutropenic fever or these sort of catastrophic type of event, like issues where they're having to isolate and everything. Because I think that what I tell patients is that unlike chemotherapy, the CDK4/6 inhibitors are generally not causing problems with the mucous membrane so that they don't have that port of entry. All they have is the low white blood cells. So all they have to do is literally stop the medication and it'll rebound very, very quickly. Wear a mask if they're neutropenic at the time around people, but not avoid family, especially around the holidays, which we're approaching now. But I think that it's really, I hope that the providers that are listening to this now can help to empower their patients to reach out and to ask for advice, because that's the best thing that they can do to keep them on these medications longer. I mean, they can work well. We can show that in studies, but if we can't keep them on the medications, then what are we doing, right? So,
no, that's a great message. It's like one of communication and information sharing. I think that's really valuable.
Yeah.
Don't forget to subscribe to the Oncology On The Go podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or anywhere podcasts are available, or listen online at cancernetwork.com/resources/podcasts. The Oncology On The Go podcast is the official podcast of cancernetwork.com, the home of the journal Oncology. For more information, visit us at cancernetwork.com and find us on Twitter at cancernetwork without the O, or on Facebook and LinkedIn at cancer-network.